Good morning, welcome. Goedemorgen. We're very happy to have such a good crowd. We're speaking English because Sarah Jane grew up in England. So
we could do it in Afrikaans, but you'd be here for a lot longer than an hour.
No, I think for 3 seconds. You would just say, "Oh, this is lekker." So welcome. This is an amazing and really interesting story that I've been recounting to people that I've come across just because it is so fascinating. Let me start with, I'm going to kind of use a shock tactic, also to some extent to shorten it because there's so much. In 1980, a baby was born in the Santon Clinic. The baby was called Caroline. Why is your book called Killing Caroline?
Oh, we really are going straight into it. Okay, good. The book is called Killing Caroline because for a number of reasons, a number of profound, very deep reasons, but essentially because the title character in the book, well, not character because it's me, was, as Ruta said, was born in Joburg in 1980. My biological mother is a white British woman. My father is a black South African, and we've probably all read Born a Crime by now. Certainly has, because it's beating my book in the bestsellers list, and obviously Born a Crime in apartheid South Africa. And so a plan had to be concocted for this baby who had been born a crime, who was neither one thing nor the other, to get out of the country. And so my biological mother and her white husband had taken me to England, had me adopted in England. This is the abridged version. And when they returned to South Africa, without their baby, who they'd said that they were taking overseas for medical treatment. They maintained that I had an illness. And it just so happens that this illness that they have, and it's a real illness, was one, essentially it was a sort of a type of jaundice. And of course jaundice makes the skin go dark or yellow. And so that's why they said, that was the reason they gave for me being darker. And they took me to the UK, said that I was going for this emergency medical treatment. And when they returned to South Africa without the baby, they had to have a reason. And the reason that they gave was that baby Caroline had died in England.
There's a little bit in between that I also found absolutely fascinating. Her mother did not know whose baby this was. So she literally waited to see if the baby would be white. And all babies are kind of brownish, pinkish when they're born.
Yeah.
So it took about a month. And then only did she come clean with her husband. So, I mean, born in drama.
Yeah. And so it continues.
Tell me about growing up colored. I mean, literally...
Well,
darker.
I hate that term. That is not a term.
I didn't mean colored in our sense.
Okay.
I meant darker than everyone around you in England. Because your parents, it sounds to me, thought that it was the best thing to just disregard it. But you seem to think that that was the worst way they could go about it.
Absolutely, because I think the inherent thing about us as human beings, and one of the things that makes us human, is the sense of identity. And the sense of the familiar and being able to look at our family particularly, but of course into wider society as well, and to be able to identify certain things, whether they be personality traits, whether it be physical, whatever it is, it's a sense of belonging. And I'm sure there's some biological reasoning behind that in a very base sense that we feel the need to belong. And so to grow up black in a very, very white part of England, in a place called Surrey, which I always say sounds like an apology, it was strange. And what's more interesting, I think, is that for a very long time, probably for about 9 years, I didn't realize that I was black. I knew that my skin was a different color, but I didn't know what black meant in the wider concept. But I knew that my skin was a different color. I knew that my hair was different. I knew my nose was different. And I knew all these things were bad. That immediately.
Why? I mean, what made you think that all these things were bad?
Because that's what I was told.
By young little girls around you with blonde hair and blue eyes.
By young little girls, by big grown men. That was very much the dialogue. And also looking on television as well, we talk about representation so much and how important it is for children. The black people that I was seeing on TV were starving Africans in Ethiopia or criminals on Crime Watch, literally. And so the positive representation of black people, black women, black little girls who looked like me were black little girls who looked like me were non-existent, but black people. Mm-hmm. And so I learned very on that this thing that I was. Just, you know, and at that age, at such a small age, it really is just about color, because the political and the rather nonsensical ideas of race haven't started to attach at that point.
It's just I'm different. I don't fit.
100%. Mm. Yeah.
But you have had an older brother,
yes,
who was also black.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my adoptive parents had adopted a boy about 2 years before they'd adopted me, who was also had one black parent, one white parent. I don't know what people call it. I'd refuse the term coloured, particularly in a South African context, but mixed race, I suppose, is the modern term, which again is nonsensical, because then you're attaching various ideas to this idea of race. But one black parent, one white parent. And so they'd adopted him, and they wanted a little girl to match, essentially. So in that sense, they were cognitive of not wanting me to be completely alone, but still it wasn't really enough to have my brother, and you know, and he came from a totally different
background. What should they have done? Because it sounds as if it was really with the best of intentions that they, and also because they were, sounds like, quite exceptional people who really did not care.
But isn't that a problem? You know, and how many times do we do things with the best of intentions, but actually it's not the best thing to do? I spend my life doing things with the best of intentions, but it's frequently not the best thing to do. What should they have done? I mean, and this in itself opens up that whole question around transracial adoption, which is such a big thing. It's not such a big thing in the UK anymore, but certainly in South Africa now, it's an enormous topic. There are so many people adopting there are so many white people adopting black children. Mm. Let's not say that there's the opposite is happening, because it isn't. But it draws into question whether that is ever a good idea.
Let's keep it personal. What
sure.
would have helped you?
I think what would have helped me was, and again, it's difficult. My parents were, to give you a bit of a brief background about my adoptive parents, my adoptive mom, who is wonderful, grew up in a very, very privileged part of the south of England, white, middle class, did the whole debutante ball thing, went to secretarial college, because that's what you did. Your father paid for you to go to secretarial college, and then you inevitably didn't go because you got married and you had children and all of this sort of thing. And she actually became a teacher. My adoptive father came from a very different background, came from the north of England, a very working class background. His father was a miner. He came from a place called Sheffield, and he came down south essentially to escape the miners' strikes, etc. So their background's very different, but they forged for themselves a very affluent life and a very privileged life. And in this, to an extent, in the same way that we are in South Africa, affluence and privilege tends to be reserved for white people, let's be honest, particularly in the Western Cape. And that certainly it was true in the UK. And so they didn't have any black friends. Not that they wouldn't have wanted any, or they would have actively chosen not to, but it just wasn't within that.
No, so we didn't have...
It was the facts of the situation. I grew up on a farm in the middle of... You know, if you ever watch things like, you know, Midsummer Murders or things yes. like that, that's where I grew up. If you've ever seen the movie The Holiday with the lovely Cameron Diaz, that's the village where I grew up. Picture perfect, sugar, you know, chocolate box village. Not too many black faces there. Mm. So in that sense, it would have been lovely to have some representation. Also, I knew nothing about South Africa until I came back here at the age of 26. Mm.
So would it have been better? I mean, because both you and your brother Aaron.
Adam. Aaron.
I'm falling
yes.
between the two now.
So many names. That's the problem with adoption.
He was called, the baby was called Aaron, and then your parents called him Adam.
Correct.
So I got
and
it
he
confused
then
now.
Went back to Aaron, which is interesting because for a while I went back to Caroline.
Okay. Mm. But you both went completely off the rails.
Yes.
Because you couldn't live with this juncture.
Yeah. Hmm? And the juncture is twofold. The juncture is there's the race element or the difference, and then there is the adoption thing. That's the issue, I think, with transracial adoption, is that you're dealing not only with the adoption, which in itself is such an enormous trauma. When we speak about adoption, we generally don't like to identify the trauma, but it's there. When you separate a child, for whatever reason, from its biological family, from its biological mother, normally when we're talking about adoption, there is a trauma there, and it's been scientifically proven that there is a pre-verbal communication that happens to a child who is adopted. And essentially, and I'm paraphrasing, but that pre-verbal communication is, I'm not good enough. If I'm being rejected by the one thing, the one person who is meant to, above all things, protect me, if I'm being rejected, how can I possibly have any value? And so many adoptees, and we speak about this in the adoptee community, have that feeling of worthlessness, not good enough, low self-esteem, which inevitably, it's a breeding ground for trauma and drama and addiction, mental health issues, all of which I have in abundance.
Tell us how it played out for both you and Adam.
So for my I'll start with Adam because he was older. So Adam had always had what they call very politely behavioral difficulties, which really means that he was a little shit at school. But again, that was that's the only swearing I'm going to do. Again, that was based, I think, in trauma, in a lack of identity, in being the only little black boy in his class, when people pulling his hair and calling him you dirty brown this and all of that kind of stuff. At the age of 12, I remember so clearly, he came home drunk for the first time. He was 12 years old. By 14 years old, he was a chronic alcoholic. And by 21, he'd committed suicide. And the life that we led was so chaotic as a result of his addiction. And I would also add, but undiagnosed mental health issues. And then when Adam died, he was 21, so I was about 18, 19, and I then started on my own destructive behavior. So it started for me with, when I was about 13, with an eating disorder. I was terrified of alcohol because of what I saw it doing to my brother, but cutting a lot of self-harm. I was absent from school a lot. I didn't like to be in school. I was very, very academic. I did very well at school, but I didn't like to be around. I had a great deal of anxiety and a great deal of depression, which, in fact, the depression wasn't diagnosed until I was about 26. But yeah, it was just there was a lot of stuff. If you know, and by the time I'd reached university, by the time I was 21, I'd also picked up alcohol. I'd also picked up drugs. I mean, you name it. If it was available, I would snort it, drink it, you know, lick it up off the floor, eat it or not eat it.
Yes, you also had eating disorders.
Yeah.
And with that went the physical representation over years.
Oh, the physical. Up, down, fat, thin. Yeah, people don't talk. We don't talk about eating disorders because they're not very glamorous things to talk about. But really, and we don't. What we also don't talk about. We like to focus on addiction being drugs and alcohol because that's what we can relate to. It seems very, you know, we've all had a drink or two and felt the buzz and thought, oh, and you can see why that would be appealing to keep doing that again and again. But when it comes to eating disorders, it's less so. Why would you want to starve yourself? Why would you want to overeat? Why would you want to overexercise? None of those have the byproduct of that is nothing pleasant, and which is why
but
we
it's
talk
also
about eating disorders
alcohol
as punishing.
And alcohol and drugs, you can actually, you know,
you can
stop, put it aside
and I have,
never do that.
Which
you can't
yeah.
stop eating.
You can't stop eating.
So you have to. It's a much more difficult thing to handle, I
Incredibly
think.
Incredibly difficult. Yeah, it's still something I battle with daily. daily. It's very, very difficult. And there's a lot of shame around it. There's an enormous amount. And that, again, comes with addiction, and I think comes just generally with issues around adoption, is this feeling of shame, not good enough, not worthy. It's the shame that comes with that. And you find yourself in a bit of a perpetual sort of circle.
But in between all of that, you manage to get 2 degrees and, you know,
ridiculous.
In the kind of outside world, you were presenting a very good facade.
I am a high-functioning recovering addict. Let me tell you that now. High-functioning. If I want you to think I'm doing well on a certain thing, I am, you know what I mean? I mean, really. If you told me to go and run up Table Mountain now, I'd do it just to prove to you that I could. Yeah, I managed to get a law degree and a master's in 4 years. How ridiculous is that?
Sarah Jane was also chosen by the readers of, what is it, Cape Town Experiences magazine.
Yes.
As the best late night presenter just recently, 2 weeks or so ago.
Thank you for mentioning that.
So that's fantastic.
Thank you.
And she says she's now moved to a weekend slot because she wants to write another book.
Is writing. It's nearly done.
No, two. At some stage, you were living with someone and you made a move to Dubai.
Yeah.
How did that happen and why?
Dear. It happened on I can tell you how it happened. It happened on a drunken job application. probably high as a kite. I honestly can't remember. I remember being online one evening and there was a job opportunity that came up in Dubai, and my life where I was at the time was starting to unravel, as it tends to do when you're in addiction. Things start unraveling. So what we tend to do as addicts is move to places. We call it doing a geographical. But unfortunately, there's something in there that's not going in, is that when you move somewhere, you take you with you. So all the problems that you have go with you. So I moved to Dubai thinking this is going to be hugely glamorous. You know, I always had that song in my head, if my friends could see me now. And everywhere I went, I'd think, oh, if my friends could see me now living this glamorous life. And of course, all of it was nonsense, because Dubai is an unequivocal hellhole, number one. and two, I was very, very unwell. This was at the height of my addiction, the height of my eating disorder, undiagnosed bipolar, and it was quite hectic, but it was a very significant move. It was a very significant move.
Sorry, you always have to have a little safety net,
a
list of crypt notes, and how did you find out what your real history was? Because your mother didn't tell you.
It wasn't that she didn't tell me in the way that, in a kind of bold and the beautiful way, and I never knew. Of course I knew. And by the time you get to about 12, 13, and you're black and your parents are white, you know, even if you're not the sharpest tool in the box, you've kind of worked out that something's not quite right. We always knew, both of us, that we were adopted. We always knew it. And to their credit, they had told us that in such a way that I can't remember ever not knowing the word adoption. Our stories were very different, but my story, I just knew that I came from this place called Africa. Not even South Africa, just Africa, which I thought was a country until I was about 10. I came from this country of Africa, and my image of Africa, thanks to largely the Telegraph newspaper and its little cutouts of please give money to the Ethiopians, was it's dusty and dirty and it's poor. And so that the history of the specifics of my adoption, no, I didn't know. I knew there was a woman called Chris. And I knew that for some reason that I couldn't quite put my finger on, she'd had to give up her baby. But it was framed in a very, she did a good thing. She did a good thing for you. Because imagine if she hadn't done that, where you would have ended up.
And then you found a letter.
Oh, dear. Yeah, I found a letter. I was as precocious a teenager as I am a 38-year-old, and I was snooping around in my mother's drawers, as I think we've all probably done from time to time, and I found this letter, and it was from my biological mother, and she'd written it about a year and a half after I was born. And it detailed, in her words, of course, the situation. She explained a little bit about her background, who she was, how she'd met her future husband, Ken, while they were both studying in England. He's a South African. And how they'd gone back to South Africa, because that's where Ken was from, to start their life. And while they were working, I just want to say this. My biological mother met my biological father in Johannesburg. She was working at this hotel in Johannesburg. Whenever I say the name of the hotel, if there's anyone from Joburg, I want to see what the reaction is. They worked at the Balalaika Hotel. I'm never wrong. There's always, yes. And suddenly it all becomes clear. Because I gather that shenanigans used to go on at the Balalaika Hotel. Shenanigans of note. So yes, she detailed in the letter everything from her perspective, of course, that had happened. And it was, I have to say, it was a very thoughtful, kind, very sad letter. Mm. But certainly...
How did that affect you? Knowing that bit of the story, of the history.
My immediate reaction was she had a choice. Mm. I couldn't get my head around why she wouldn't have just left South Africa. Mm. And to this day, I still ask that question. Mm. I don't have children of my own, but I have a dog, and that's pretty much the same thing, isn't it? And I know that if the choice was between me giving up my digest, but really, I couldn't get my head around this idea that there was an option, but that she chose
not to.
She chose her husband. She chose South Africa. She chose anything but me. I'm not quite sure. Yeah, it was hard. Again, I should just point out that the political aspect of my birth and my existence and my adoption still didn't fully understand. I didn't really understand apartheid. So, but from a very human level, excuse me, I couldn't understand why she as a mother hadn't simply said, then I go back to England and I raise my baby.
Mm. You contacted the adoption agency then at the age of 21. Was that when it was legally possible?
No, it was legally possible from the age of about 18.
Yeah.
But with your parents' permission, I could have done it earlier. It was never an issue for me. I was kind of getting on with my own life, far too busy taking drugs to worry about whether this woman, and also I should point out in the years following my adoption, my biological mother had over the years sent a couple of letters to the adoption agency giving her address. So I always thought, well, this is her keeping an avenue open. So I'm not in a hurry. It's not like I have to hunt this woman down, because we know where she is, or we can very easily find out. It was when I was 21, I was just about to go to varsity. And I thought, I sort of had 6 weeks before I was due to go. And I thought, let me do this. Now is the time. Now feels right.
And what response did you get?
Oh, dear. Not good. I remember I wrote the letter to her, and everything went through the adoption agency and whatever. And I wrote this very heartfelt letter. And in it, and I so regret writing that letter now, because I took on her shame and her guilt. And I kind of forgave her for everything, when actually that wasn't really how I felt. I just didn't want to be rejected again. I didn't want to go in guns a-blazing and have her reject me. So I went in very tentatively, and it's fine, and I understand, and you da da. And my first week at university, I'd gone back home to get my washing done by my mum, spoilt. And she said, there's a letter for you here. And it was from my biological mother. And in it, she basically said, you were the worst mistake I ever made. Don't contact me again. And I think for about 2 days, I was absolutely crushed and beside myself and cried. And then thereafter, I just buried it. Mm. I buried it, and I drank on it, and I cut on it, and I over-exercised and binged and purged and got into inappropriate relationships. And I buried it deep, deep down, because it was so painful. Mm. You're the worst mistake I ever made, she said.
You got the same kind of response from her parents, because you went through
people.
Them to get to her.
Yeah.
And they also said...
They said, we've made a family decision, and we don't want anything to do with you. And I thought, this is, and also she was able to hide behind her family a lot. I was able to learn quite a lot about her through her family, but they built up a wall. Mm. And they were not going to have anything to do with me. And you know what? The thing was, in writing to her, and I think people always want to have a happy adoption reunion story. And people always ask me, it's always the question they ask, have you met your biological mother? Or have you ever been in touch with her? And you know what? For 99.9% of the adoptees that I know, when we reach out to our biological families, it's not because we want another family. We've got a family. We've had a family. It's never the family that we grew up in is our family. However flawed they may be, whatever attachment there may be or may not be, they are still our family. They're the only one we've known. What we want is answers. Mm. We just want to know, who am I? Who am I? Mm. Yeah.
And at the adoption agency, you did find one thing that would help to give you something, yes, of that, and that was a photograph.
Yes. So a photograph fell out of this file, and it was of a little blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy, and on the back of it had a name. I must be careful, because in the book I use some pseudonyms, and sometimes I blurt out the name, and people go, oh, I know a so-and-so, and I think, oh, dear. There was a little boy, and that was my half-brother. My biological mother had gone on a year and a half after I was born. She gave birth to my brother with her husband. We definitely know the identity of his father. at least we hope we do. And imagine if she's sitting in this room. This is the thing about adoption. Sorry, Rita. This is the thing about adoption, is that my biological mother could be sitting in this room now, and I'd have no idea who she is. Mm-hmm. No idea who
it's
she is.
It's a weird thought, huh?
And if you are here, I'll see you outside. I'm joking.
But then you made contact with your half-brother.
I made contact with
him. And he responded differently.
He did respond differently. Initially, he did respond differently. He had no idea about this sister. He really had no idea. And I felt so guilty getting in touch. And we had tried to go through his father, so her ex-husband, because we wanted them to be able to break it to him, rather than a social worker from an adoption agency in London phoning up and saying, oh, hello, is this so-and-so? Just to let you know, you've got a half-sister. She's black. But that is what happened. And I feel so sad to this day that that's what happened, because, I mean, he literally got a phone call out of nowhere saying, is this you? Are these your parents? He confirmed yes, and then they broke the news to him. And I, as guilty as I feel about it, I still think he had a right to know. I don't regret doing it. Mm. And when I eventually came back to South Africa, we met, and yeah, for a while it was okay.
Okay, well, I can see you want to park that.
No, I said to you at the start, ask me anything. I don't want to park it at all.
But so let's go back now to Dubai. So you're in Dubai. Mm. Your life is completely falling apart.
Yeah.
You, whenever you can get hold of alcohol, you're beyond drunk.
Beyond.
Your relationship is
pathetic.
Falling apart.
Disintegrating.
How did it happen that you came to Johannesburg?
Mm. So I lost my job. I lost everything in Dubai. I lost my job, and my mother had to fly out. I mean, how shameful. My mother had to fly out, and her and my sort of boyfriend at the time had sort of held a bit of an intervention and said, you need to get help. And I thought, oh, God, okay, fine. And it was around the same time that Amy Winehouse song came out. They said I had to go to rehab. What's it called? They tried to make me go to rehab, and I said no, no, no. I in fact said yes, 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 because I thought I could do with a holiday. And so my mom said, find somewhere to go. And let me tell you, the only reason really that I went to Johannesburg is because a friend of mine who I was friends with, a girl who I knew in Dubai, had been to South Africa for treatment, and she said, go to South Africa. It's cheaper than England. And the weather's great. And I thought, that is a hole in one. I'm in. I wish the reason was better. Like, oh, I just felt such a pull to South Africa. I didn't at that time. I didn't have a pull to anything other than a bottle of Jack Daniels. They said to me, go. I said, okay. And on the 17th of August, I landed in Johannesburg for the first time since I'd left, on an almost 26 years to the day that I'd left, I touched down at O.R. Tambo.
And August, of course, as a Joburger, is the ugliest month of the year. It was horrible.
Beautiful. It was. When you
Coming from Dubai.
When you fly in Joburg and it's sunset. Come on. That, and you're flying over. That's beautiful. Maybe I'm romanticizing it. Let's not forget, this is my last opportunity to drink. So I was absolutely wrecked on the aeroplane. In my mind, it was probably fantastic. There was probably turbulence and it was probably horrendous. But in my drunken memory.
We'll take it. But then your rehab centers are also, there's a reason why so many dramas are written by addicts and set in rehab centers, because this turned out to be a bit of a nightmare in the end.
It did.
And not because of anything you did.
Amazingly not. Now, when I was in rehab, the reason that I put this story that I'm about to tell you in the book was to signify my vulnerability rather than to rat out anybody. But in rehab, you are broken down. You are absolutely stripped bare of everything. So in order that you can be built up again.
And you have to face things sober for the first time.
For the first time. You have to face everything sober. Getting up, going to sleep, other people. And while I was in treatment, the therapist who had been assigned to me, so awful. She was quite mad, but I had forged a bond with her, a bond that I don't think I'd had with anybody. She almost became, and this is why I put it in the book, a mother figure. And the book is largely about mother figures and the different mothers I've had in my life. And that's why I put this particular anecdote in. But I discovered that after a while that she was having an affair with one of the patients in the clinic. Not only was she having an affair with him, he was a complete crack addict who was mental. And she took me into her confidence in this rehab center. And so every time that I would go in for a one-on-one therapy session with her, she'd sit and be all moony-eyed over, the long-haired crack addict who she was sleeping with in her office. I know you couldn't write this stuff, except that I have. It's in that book. Please buy it. Really, the reason that I wrote that particular anecdote, yes, it's a little bit funny, but more to illustrate how absolutely she completely took advantage of the trust that I put in her. And when it all came out, and it was devastating, because this guy actually ended up taking the keys to the medicine cabinet from her bag and overdosing on Vicetone, which is a heroin substitute, and it was very ugly. The devastation of having to, first of all, having to be keep this secret that was nothing to do with me, but then to also feel that I'd been so betrayed by this woman when I'd shared with her things that I hadn't shared with anyone. And like you say, you have to face up to stuff in rehab or you may as well not be there, and it's not cheap either. So you really do have to, you are broken down to be built up again. And I'd shared with this woman so much, and she completely betrayed my confidence.
Well, what struck me was, as you say, that how desperately vulnerable people are in that kind of situation. And if you then betray them in whatever way, I mean, this is a very dramatic example, but it's just unforgivable.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then you transferred to a place in Cape Town.
I transferred to a place in Cape Town. And I was in treatment for a total of 8 months. Mm. 8 months.
That's Sarah Jane. How difficult is it to come back from that kind of addiction?
The difficult part isn't necessarily the coming back. The difficult part is the keeping where you are. It's the stuff that happens after. It's life, isn't it? Life's difficult. Coming clean, and I've been clean and sober now. It'll be 13 years on this August the 17th. And I haven't taken a drink, drug, anything. That initially, yes, it's very tough. Well, in the very early stages. But then you find ways to deal with the drugs and the alcohol and not having those. And all those very destructive behaviors. But what then you realize is that actually the issue wasn't drugs at all. Mm. The issue wasn't alcohol at all. The problem was me, and the problem was all the other stuff. Mm. And all the other stuff isn't quite as easy to put in a cupboard and lock the door as the drugs and alcohol.
And how do you deal? Because this is, I mean, it is a daily thing.
Listen, I mean, I at the risk of breaking anonymity, I go to, you know, various meetings that are held in churches and and halls around the place. But I also have a very strong network of people who are also quite mad and recovering from addiction. And it really helps because I'm able to phone them up and say, this is how I'm feeling today. And they get it. Therapy is great. Going to see a professional and paying them extortionate amounts of money is fine if you can afford to do it. But actually, there's nothing better than one-on-one saying to somebody who you know has been at the rock bottom that you've been at and sharing your experience. That is better than anything. And you know, and rehab is also fine. If you want to go to rehab, go to rehab. I went to rehab because I needed to be in a place where I was no longer a danger to myself or others. And it was rehab or prison. And I wouldn't do well in prison. So, it was rehab. But the work that I've done that's got me to the point today, and listen, don't get me wrong, still, things are not, you know, I live with a serious mental health condition. I'm bipolar. I have borderline personality. And that's tough. There are days that I don't want to get out of bed. Really, there are days that I still want to take a blade to my arms and hack them to pieces. I don't these days, but I feel that. There are days when I'm suicidal and I have to go into a clinic and doctors have to look after me. And I have no shame about talking about any of that because there are other people who are also experiencing. And if I don't talk about it, who is going to talk about it? Who is going to sit there and say, you know what? I woke up the other morning and I literally wanted to kill myself. I didn't, but I felt like it. That's how bad I felt. I've got no shame talking about it at all. And I think that is also the key to my recovery, is that I've thrown the shame away. I can't. Shame and recovery cannot coexist. It's simply not possible. 100%.
I've seen that also with PTSD. You know, South Africa especially, I mean, this is a white audience. How many of the men have been, you must all have been to the army. You're all, if I didn't paint it, I would have the same color hair. I mean, the whole border war experience here, and the people who come back from that, and I've heard so many, talk to so many of them who say exactly the same thing, that I cannot speak to a therapist who's half my age, knows nothing about this, but I can speak to someone who was there, and who can really say, I understand.
Exactly.
Yeah. So tell me about connecting with, you call him Alex in the book, your half-brother, and then there's a whole bigger family there.
So I first met my half-brother, I was still in treatment, I was still in rehab, and I'd got a pass to go out. They don't like you to just go wandering around the streets, it's not sensible, but I got a pass to go out, and we'd been communicating via email for maybe a couple of years at that point. I think just as I moved to Dubai, we got in touch. And then I was in treatment, and we got in touch, and he'd been sailing around the world, as Cape Townians do, as Bishop's boys do. And he came back, and we met for the first time in 2007, I guess it was, and we met at Rick's, I remember it so clearly, at Rick's Cafe in Gardens in Cape Town, and I just remember sitting there, and it was raining, so it must have been around August, September, so it was raining, a miserable Cape Town evening, and there was this plastic sheeting over the thing, this rain was sort of pattering against the plastic, and as I saw him walking towards me, and for the first time in my life, I saw someone who looked like me. And that's a very strange thing to say that this, you know, this white, blonde, white South African male looked like me. But I looked into his eyes and I could see my eyes and my smile and my forehead. And I thought, this is the best moment of my life. It was phenomenal. And he sat down at the table and we shook hands. I should say about Alex is that Alex, as similar as we are in some ways, we are very different in others. I'm hugely emotional. Alex is a lot more together. Because they teach that to you at Bishop's, don't they? They teach you to be very together, not to show your emotion. And he was very kind of together, and I was all over the place. And we for 10 years we had a relationship. We certainly tried to have a relationship.
And then
I wrote a book.
Oh dear.
And then I wrote a book which outed his entire family as not being particularly nice people, and outed his mother. Because don't forget, I should just say that the lie of our baby died, that had continued. Even once apartheid was over, there was no point at which they then came out and said, we told a terrible lie, this was the reality. That lie continued and would have continued if I'd never come back, and people would have believed that.
Your kin's parents, did they also believe that their grandchild had died?
Rita, I initially, yes. I'm not quite sure.
Where they're at now?
No. I met Ken. So Ken is my biological mother's
husband,
or was husband. Yeah. And he was the guy who thought this, that for a long time I was his baby. Well, certainly for three weeks of my life. I'm not sure. I met his father once in a very, very awkward moment at a wedding, and he literally looked like he wished the floor could open up and cave in. But I don't know. This is the problem with, you know, secrets and lies. Mm. Is that you
it
never
reverberates.
Quite and reverberates. You never quite know who knows what.
And then there was a very last chapter which happened through Twitter.
Thank goodness. Let's be clear, it happened through Black Twitter. Black Twitter is a very different beast to Twitter. Black Twitter is where we all galvanize and talk about you. No, it's not. Black Twitter...
I'm learning Zulu. That is actually true.
It really is, though, isn't it? Black Twitter is a movement. It's a thing that happens. And so I did an interview, after the book came out, I did an interview on Cape Talk, where I work, with Koketso Sachani, who was at the time standing in for Eusebius. And so it was going on Cape Talk and 702. We're having a conversation about the book. And during an ad break, he said to me, do you want to give the real name of your dad? Because I'd used pseudonym, or your biological father, I'd used pseudonyms in the book to protect the innocent and the not so innocent. And so I said, I don't know. I was so terrified that I was now going to disrupt somebody else's life. And he said, SJ, just do it. He said, you've written this book, and that has been a great thing. He said, but I can see for you, you're so desperate to find your dad. So I gave his real name, and within 24 hours, Black Twitter had galvanized. Somebody had sent me a message in my inbox, and it just had a name and a telephone number. And they said, could this be your father? Within 24 hours, less than 24 hours. And so I phoned the number, my boyfriend phoned the number, actually, and we were sitting in our house and sitting in our bedroom, and he was phoning, and he said... He phoned and he said, is this Mr. Makwala, and did you used to work at the Balalaika Hotel? And my dad said, no. And so I was devastated, and I thought, well, that's it. Because I'd hired private investigators to find him. Nobody could find him. Just as we were about to put the phone down, my dad said, well, it was a really long time ago. And in that moment, and I knew, and I grabbed the phone, and I just burst into tears, and I said, "I'm your daughter." And I said I wasn't going to swear again, but I'm quoting someone, so I'm allowed. His reaction when I said, "I'm your daughter. You had a relationship with Chris so and so in 1980," he said, "Oh shit." yeah, oh shit. And a week later, we met in Joburg, and I met my biological father. And
describe that moment.
I thought meeting Alex was the best moment of my life. Meeting my dad, that was the best moment of my life.
And have they, there were pictures, they have accepted you?
150%. They are just the most incredible, wonderful, accepting, not even, I hate the word accepting because it sounds like there's something to be accepting of, but they have welcomed me. I am part of the family. I've got two brothers and a sister. We speak probably most days on the phone. And I look like all of them. I really look like all of them, which I love. I love that. I love that I know where the little gap in my front teeth comes from. I love that I know where the frown lines come from. And I love that I know where I love that I have an identity. And it's not that I didn't have one before, but it's that now my identity has roots.
My last question before I hand over to the audience, your adoptive mum,
yes.
How has she responded?
That's a tough one. I always wish when I get asked that question that we could Skype her in, because, again, you never quite know. I can only go on how I think. she loves me to death. You know, I'm her child. However, it must be difficult. All I will say is it must be difficult. It must be difficult. She met my dad at Christmas. She flew out from England, and I was in Joburg for Christmas, and she met my dad. Imagine that. Mom, meet dad. It was really like that. We were at Monte Cassino, and it was the most surreal moment as my mom met my dad. And it was awkward. I'm not going to lie. It was awkward, and it was tough, and it was difficult, and I wanted it to be over. But it had to happen because this is who my life is. My life isn't my biological mother. That's, you know, she must, Darla, what she must. But I, for me, these are the people who...
These are all parts of the puzzle that make you. Yes.
Yeah, I should probably ask her one day, but, it's difficult. It's difficult. She's very supportive, though.
Questions from you. This is such an astonishing story. There's a microphone, I think, over there. But this is actually a good environment one can hear.
Yes, it's lovely. Not a single question.
I don't believe it.
There. I just wondered, before you published the book, did you tell Alex that you'd written it and that he was going to be in it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And did he immediately...
He said... No, not immediately. We went for dinner, and I said, this is the book. And he said, we support you 100%. And then over a few weeks, it became less. I get it. It's hard. It's hard to hear these things about your parent. It's hard if you are... Which is another reason I changed the names. If you don't know who they are, you don't know who they are. If you do know who they are, you do know who they are. I didn't want to cause him any unnecessary angst, but nobody's forcing him to read the book. And nobody knows who he is unless they do, in which case they know the story already. One day I hope he'll be okay.
So you don't see each other now?
No.
At the moment?
No.
It's
okay.
At the back there?
Your biological father knew nothing about you?
He actually did. This hasn't been another thing. Thank you for that question. In meeting him, I've learned so much about the first 6 weeks of my life. My biological mother took me to go and see him. He was still working at the Balalaika, took me into the kitchen somewhere, he was the head chef, to go and see, and he says to me, he's told this story, that she was holding me and there was a blanket covering me, and he pulled the, and it was August, you know, it was cold in Joburg, he pulled the blanket off and he said to my biological mother, that baby is a Makwala. But what could he possibly have done? What could he possibly have done? So he did know. But he was also told the story of the baby was dead, but then apparently she went to see him. I mean, he promptly left the Balalaika Hotel, as you can imagine, once I was born. But they somehow met when she'd returned from England, and apparently she said to him, the baby is still alive. I gave the baby away.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, so he knew that?
Yeah.
All these years.
He said to me that a friend of his had said, when she's 21, she'll come and find you. And he said to me that 21 came and went, and 25 came and went, and 30 came and went, and 35 came and went, and he thought, no, never.
Mm.
And then there she was.
Hello.
I'll speak loudly. You were born in South Africa, you grew up in England, you live in South Africa now. Do you feel a sense of home in South? Do you have a sense of familiarity or...
South Africa is home. 100% South Africa is home. I can't even describe it. I wish I could be a lot more articulate around it. But in fact, and when those wheels touched down on the 17th of August 2007, literally as the wheels touched down at OR Tambo, I felt like I was home. And I can't explain that. I've always felt at home. And it's strange because I sound the way I do. And I don't speak, to my shame, I don't speak any South African languages, and yet I still feel at home. Yeah, I can't explain it. I just do.
It's because here we're such a bondspil. You know, we all look different, and we're so used to people looking different and having different backgrounds, I think it is easier. We don't expect people to all fit into the same box.
You know, you say that, Ruda, but what's interesting is that people still raise an eyebrow to somebody who is mixed race. There's a difference between, we know we can deal with black, that's it. White, okay, yeah, got that. Coloured, yeah, I mean, we've made that term up and it's a complete nonsense, but we know what that looks like. People don't know what to do with this. It still really baffles people. Because there's not many of us. When I came back to South Africa, I thought there's going to be loads of mixed race people because I was ignorant and didn't know anything. But of course there aren't loads. There's me and Trevor Noah. We are the best of friends.
Who have said anything?
Who've said anything? But there really aren't as many as there should be, as you would imagine. Where it literally is your mother is black or your one parent is black and one is white. There's not a lot of that. There's more of us happening. Look out for us, because there's a lot more happening. But really, there is still something, as much as we, and I can say this as the person, and I get to view people's reactions and I get to see the raised eyebrows. There is still a stigma to black and white relationships in South Africa. Let's not kid it. We can't kid ourselves about it. We can't pretend it's not an issue. Even I do a double take when I see an interracial couple. I do. I can't help it.
More questions?
That's a worldwide phenomenon, not just South Africa.
No, not in England. No. 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 Probably midway between the two.
I really don't think it's a great subject.
But you're speaking as a white person. What is your experience as a person who is...
Yeah, I don't think we'll agree to disagree.
No,
one would have to do enormous sociological research to establish. Other questions? At the back there.
Thank you. I think your top's amazing.
More?
I appreciated your comment on your mental
health. Please take the mic because I don't think people at the back can hear.
I did appreciate your comments about your mental health. And the reason I'm saying that is because I'm suffering from the same thing.
Sure.
And the change came when I made peace with it. Mm. And I said, that's part of me. Mm. I don't have to be ashamed of it. I just have to live with it.
Yeah.
And I must manage it.
Yeah.
If you don't manage it, it can be very dangerous.
Very.
So what you've said there, I've also experienced many times. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks.
I did two series for CakeNet, A Lever Met, A Life With, on mental health issues.
Mm.
And in every single case, that came through. That when you come to the point where you actually recognize it, name it, start working with it, then there can be a change. Mm. And with that, of course, goes the stigma thing, that the more people talk about it, the easier it becomes for everyone to accept it, and that then a lever met, a life with, it's not something you take a tablet for and then tomorrow you feel better.
Exactly.
It is something you have to find a way to work with. More conversation?
Hi, welcome. I do the Writers Festival. I'm so glad you're here.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you.
And I'm so glad to see the audience. I was just wondering, what's your experience of this festival and the day or two that you are here?
I'm literally here for a day. I arrived about an hour before this started. I'm hoping to come actually and see Rudis thing tomorrow. I love Stellenbosch, so I invite me to Stellenbosch anytime and I'll come. I wish I could answer your question better. I don't know. I obviously I love talking about myself, but I love, I love talking books. I love talking life. So I love book festivals. I love, and book people are book people.
Mm.
Book people, that transcends race. If you're a book person, you're a book person.
You're also going to be on RSG, the Afrikaans Radio Service.
Wish I knew when that was. I wish you didn't.
1:00-ish.
I think it's at 1 or 2-ish.
I heard a promo.
Did you?
This morning. Yeah.
Good.
So, Yeah, I was very smart and new age, and I streamed RSG nogal.
By then, I'll have learned how to pronounce it. By the time I'm on, I'll have learned how to pronounce it. Good.
Please?
The theme of your next book?
Mental health.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, mental health. It goes, I touch on it in Killing Caroline, but I didn't, that wasn't the story, and this is a lot more. And I just hope that when people read it, whether you are somebody who lives with mental health issues or whether you are somebody who is who knows somebody who is, you will get a bit of an insight and you'll find it helpful or something. It's all about stripping the shame. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It was most enjoyable.
What a lovely conversation. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Jane will be outside to sign books if you want. There's a book table. You would have seen it coming up the stairs. Thank you all for sharing this time and enjoy the festival.
Thank you.